Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Professional Insights Podcast. Third season. Yeah, it is
third
the third
wave.
Season. The third season being recorded in the third wave. Thank you, COVID-19. Thank you very much to our sponsors, Brand Boulevard, not COVID-19, Brand Boulevard. For all the help and that you do. My name is Brandon Curry.
I'm Jeff Collins.
Josh Bond.
And Trevor Lindy.
And we have our favorite guest. Well, yeah, we'll say that. Grant LaFleche can go pound it. But I love Grant. Come on. I just love busting his chops. Sarah Ives is here. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me back. I think this is my number 3.
Yes, it was 4, yep. But it's 3. Yeah, 3.
Okay. So, we'll touch very briefly. Can you please tell us what has happened to your company since we've last talked to you?
Sure. So I think we last spoke, it must have been like early or mid-fall of 2020. Yep. So since then, the company I work for, Distributed Bio, we got acquired by a large contract research organization called Charles River Laboratories. There's about, I think, more than 14,000 employees. It's a global company. They work with biotech and pharmaceutical companies around the globe, and they have touched almost every drug that has come to market, both for small molecule and biologics. So it was a long time coming. We've been in partnership with them for more than 2 years before the acquisition. So it was all, you know, hush hush before the acquisition, so I couldn't talk about it. But on December 31st, 2020, we were officially acquired by Charles River. And Charles River purchased the services part of Distributed Bio. So that's the part where we discover and engineer antibody drugs as therapeutics. And then the therapeutic discovery or the therapeutic pipeline of Distributed Bio was spun out as a separate company called Centivax. So those are all the therapeutics that were not run as services for other pharma and biotech, but the internal development pipeline. So now there's two companies, there's Charles River and there's Centivax. My role, it didn't change too much. So now I'm just an employee of Charles River Labs. That is my day job. I am the director of strategic partnerships there at the Distributed Bio site. They're still calling us Distributed Bio to set us apart from the other Charles River sites. There's actually one like across the parking lot that does like neurological research. A lot of big changes.
Neurological research?
I think they work on studying how new and upcoming small molecule drugs will behave in the brain.
Okay.
Yeah, it's called Brains. It's a company called Brains Online that they acquired a couple of years ago. So now there's two Charles River sites in South San Francisco, and we're happy to be part of the Charles River family. It's actually a pretty easy transition because we're all, I think, ready for it for a long time, having that structure of a big company and everything that goes with it. And now I work for a large publicly traded company and kind of settling into that lifestyle. So, and more responsibility since I'm taking on a slightly different role. So that's exciting too, to keep things fresh. And then in addition to that, I am still working with Centivax, leading the flu vaccine program. I'm actually an advisor to Centivax, so basically like a consultant. And I am taking the lead in making sure our animal studies move forward and using our money that we got from the Gates Foundation grant. Mm-hmm. And those studies are underway, so I'm working on that as well.
Are you filming Pandemic 2 yet?
A lot of people have asked me that. I haven't heard anything about a season 2, but that would be pretty awesome.
Oh, yeah, it'd be cool, especially where we're at now with everything, you know, so it'd be interesting.
Yeah, because it came out, like, right before it hit, and then it'd be interesting to do, like, a post-mortem, like, well, were we ready? But maybe it's too soon for all that. And like, I don't know if people want to watch a show about a virus at this point.
I guess we're gonna see. But, we just want to watch shows about people hugging each other. It's like,
I know.
I just want to shake someone's hand.
Yeah. Well, like it is kind of scary because the flu pandemic is still lurking out there on the horizon. Like it will still happen.
Yeah.
And we are obviously not ready. So. I mean, everything that was said in that documentary either came true, and if it hasn't yet, it will be true at some point in the future. So definitely still worth the investment from a public health and a scientific and a societal perspective to get our ducks in a row for when it does happen, because we got spared with the coronavirus pandemic with the fact that although it is a horrible virus and a deadly disease, and we still don't understand the full effects of post-COVID recovery, it is manageable and the death rate is low. We won't always be that lucky with pandemics. So, but that's what makes me excited to work in the career that I do and go to work every day and research new therapies. So
you can save lives, thousands and thousands of lives, right? So.
Millions,
I guess potentially.
The question that I get all the time, so there's a couple that I so one, is your flu vaccine on ferrets now?
Yes, so that's some of the big updates we have since the last time we spoke is I initiated, with our team and our collaborators, two animal studies with the Gates Foundation money. There is a study in ferrets and a study in pigs, and they're actually almost identical studies, but run in different species, basically for two different reasons. So the ferrets, so both studies are an adjuvanting study. So it's testing out a couple formulations of our Centivax flu vaccine, our universal vaccine. And each cohort of animals has a different adjuvant. So we're testing out which adjuvant will provide the best serological response, like the best antibodies after the fewest number of shots. So we're hoping to do like one and done, like just one shot, but maybe a shot and a boost, kind of like we have for the COVID vaccines would also be acceptable. If it's a shot and two boosts, that's sort of less ideal, but we're looking to reduce total adjuvant exposure by having less total shots, but also getting a strong enough response that will protect against future and all versions of flu. So this is just an adjuvanting study. These animals will not get sick with influenza. We're just injecting them with the vaccine and then drawing their blood every 28 days to monitor their antibody response. And then once those studies are done, then we'll do a challenge study. So we'll pick whichever one was the winner from the adjuvant study, and then we vaccinate the animals. And then they get sprayed in the nose with influenza. And then that's the true test. Like, did they get sick or did they not? Does the vaccine work? So I'm definitely nervous for that. And we're actually making it extra hard on ourselves because for the challenge study, we're going to formulate our vaccine as if it were the year 2008. So we only have information from influenza from about 1918 when we have the first sequence through 2008. So that's the information we'll use to formulate our vaccine. And then we're going to infect them with the H1N1 2009 swine flu. Ooh. So that's a future virus. and that's also that big pandemic shift event when everybody got sick because no one had prior immunity because the 2008 vaccines did not work at all against the 2009 virus. And now all H1N1s that are circulating since 2009 look relatively similar to that one. So it's like a big shift event. And so that's what we're going to do to our animals, both our pigs and our ferrets, is we're going to test them. Does it future-proof them?
When's this done?
Let's see. So the ferret and the pig adjuvant studies will be done in June. So I'm hoping by the end of June, we'll have the readouts. Let's see. So end of June, they'll get their last blood draw. So we could start as early as July for the challenge study, and then it's only like a 2 or 3 month study, just enough time to like give them the vaccine, maybe give them a boost, wait a little while, and then infect them.
So what happens if everything's fully perfect, it works like it's supposed to?
If they're fully, if it's perfect, then all the animals that got the Centivax flu vaccine will not get sick. They won't have any virus replicating in their trachea, their lungs, or their nose. They won't have any symptoms. They won't have any fever. They won't have any cough. And then all the animals that are in the negative control group that receive a vaccine of saltwater should all get sick. And we also have like a positive control arm where they're going to get vaccinated, I think, with the 2009 antigen mix. So they definitely should not get sick. So basically have a negative control, positive control. And then we're actually testing out a couple different formulations of Centivax. Like 2008 was a long time ago. So we want to make sure that we have like a more modern formulation. So we're going to do like a, I think like a 2018 or 2019 formulation, just to make sure that everything's all good. And we have a couple different variations for tweaking it. Which actually brings me to the reason why we're doing pigs and ferrets. Ferrets are the one animal model that is required for flu before you can start a human clinical trial. It's kind of odd. Like normally in drug development, you go from doing stuff on the bench, like in tubes, to mice. And then once you prove that it works in mice, then there's usually a study in monkeys. It may just be a toxicity study, or there may be some efficacy involved there, depending on the disease. So it goes mice, monkey, and then humans. For flu, it's a little different because mice don't actually get sick with flu. And you can use mice in flu research, it's just not the best model. And monkeys, again, monkeys have been used, but they aren't really like the gold standard for testing flu because they don't get sick in the way that humans do. But ferrets actually do. I don't really know why, but they develop the same symptoms. They get the cough, the fever, the malaise, and they produce very, very strong antibody titers to flu vaccines. So that's just what is used. And it's a lot cheaper than a ferret is cheaper than a monkey as well. So
I've heard that. I've heard
that. We're happy for that. Monkeys are very, very expensive. It is very hard to do monkey research. So we're happy about that. We don't have to do that. So basically that's why we're doing ferrets, is because that's our path to our phase one human clinical trials. Do the adjuvant study in ferrets and then do the challenge study in ferrets. And then we can start a clinical trial. So we are already starting to prepare material to file an IND, which is investigational new drug. It's all the paperwork you need to actually start a phase one trial. And you have to get FDA approval just to do that. So that's all in the works. And then the pig is because, well, one, having it work in multiple species just makes the data package a lot more robust. So we know it's not just like a fluke or just a ferret specific thing. Like if it works in pigs and it works in ferrets, it's probably going to work in humans. But the more pressing reason why we're doing it in pigs is because we would like to sell it on the veterinary market, which I think we maybe touched on last time. But there's a huge need for a universal flu vaccine in the veterinary market too, because when there's a bad strain going around for humans, it either started in pigs or is also infecting pigs or infect them the next year. But the pig and the swine farm industry is like a reservoir for flus. So like lots of different circulating flus, lots of chances for genetic recombination of influenza. And then when farms do get an outbreak, they have to quell all of their animals, which is very sad and disruptive to the marketplace and that particular business and the whole economy, especially when it's like huge factory farms. And basically we want to avoid having to do that at all costs. So if we can eliminate influenza reservoir in swine, then we think that it will not only help with spreading among pigs, but also it'll help with mitigating the spread from pigs to humans, which is where a pandemic will probably come from, either from birds to humans, pigs to humans, or birds to pigs to humans, like all three.
So you're proactive rather than reactive. That's great. Like,
yeah. And it's also just a way for us to make money on the way to human clinical trials, because those are expensive. Mm-hmm. And while we would like to use basically grant money and money that we can make rather than borrowing money like from investors to the extent that we can. And having a viable product on the veterinary market is a way for us to actually make some cash to fund later stage clinical trials. And it's, again, great proof of concept that if it works in pigs, it's a viable product, it's administered to, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of pigs every year, it's safe, it works, that's a pretty good indication that it's going to do just fine in humans
too. I'll fly down, I'll do it for free. If you want a human to do the needle, yeah,
we'll volunteer, Brendan.
We'll volunteer. Yeah, don't.
You can have him.
Perfectly healthy.
It's so funny.
Skip the pigs and the ferrets. Go right to
I'll
Brendan.
I'll probably get a third eye, but you know what? I don't care. I won't get the flu, so it's fine.
I've had so many people reach out to me on social media because they watch a show, and in the show, it's like, hey, we needed a shot and 6 booster shots to get these really great neutralizing antibodies. And so the whole like premise of our part in the show is like, can we reduce it down to 3 shots and then down to 1 and done? And so many people were like, if I don't ever get flu again, and if it prevents a pandemic, like, sure, I'll take 7 shots. Like, why keep going? Just stop there.
As long as I get, I'll trip to California. I get to be in a nice warm climate. I'll consider it a vacation and an investment into my future. That's the way I look at it. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Can we do that on a podcast where you inject him with flu?
I'll do it. 100%. I'll do it on the podcast.
Well, that'll be the next Netflix thing. Make it happen.
Yeah exactly. There's some ethical concerns. I think I'd want to make sure that
let them meet Brendan for like an hour and there'll be no concerns anymore. They'll volunteer them.
Yeah.
Once it looks good in a challenge study, then I would feel a lot better about that. Because we know it makes good antibodies, but whether or not they're truly protective, the safety I'm less concerned about. I mean, we still have all the rigorous safety protocols that we'll have to pass before starting a phase 1 clinical trial. But the material itself is just inert protein. It's a subunit-based vaccine. So there's no live virus. There's no whole virus. There's no dead virus. There's no weakened virus. It's just like the some surface coat proteins around the outside of influenza, just those little proteins by themselves. So there's no genetic material. There's no way that the virus can replicate. It's just these little chunks that are like engineered in the laboratory without the virus itself. So it should be safe. And all the adjuvants that we're testing out in our study are adjuvants that have a route forward to the clinic. So they're either already approved adjuvants in existing vaccines, or they've been through at least a phase 1 clinical trial. In for some vaccine.
So you said the magic word there. Have you been vaccinated yet for COVID-19?
I have. I feel very fortunate, a little bit guilty actually, because
you had an extra one. You said it's true.
No, I got the Pfizer vaccine. So Charles River employees, at least at our site, we in the county I work in, which is San Mateo County, were classified as food and agriculture workers, which is a little bit strange to me because, well, I'm not going to question it, but somehow I got paperwork from HR and I was able to schedule an appointment at the Stanford Clinic in Redwood City. And so I got my first shot and I actually got my second shot 2 weeks ago today. So I am supposedly fully protected now, or as good as it's going to get. And I feel incredibly fortunate and very optimistic about science that we got to this point, even though it's a year into the pandemic, but like, wow, it was such a turning point for me because this is the moment when the pandemic shifts from ramping up to ramping down, at least for me. Cause like, I no longer have to worry about my own safety as much. I mean, I still worry about the safety of all my friends and family that haven't gotten the vaccine, but it's just like, such a relief knowing that at least mentally when I wear a mask, it's more just for show and it's not because I'm actually concerned about dying from COVID.
We're all friends in the show here. Can you mail us some vaccines, like just 8 of them? We're trying. Did you get any symptoms at all?
The first one I did not. My arm was a little sore for like a day or two, but I felt totally fine. The second one, I slept 12 hours, 11 or 12 hours that night that I got it. But I also, I don't know if it was because I was fatigued or if I just cleared my meetings the next day and didn't set an alarm. Because I think like I have a tendency to just sleep 11 hours if no one wakes me up.
Right.
So, but I did get hives. Yeah, I had hives for about 48 hours after getting it. It was.
Didn't you tell us the story where you had hives before? Didn't you tell us a story about?
Were you trying to go there again?
I don't know.
Yeah, the that was the trip to North Dakota, right? Or
oh here. Yeah,
it's the bed bugs.
I got
oh the bed bugs. Yeah, that's
yes, what it was. In Montana. Yeah, similar to hives, very itchy. Actually, the bed bugs are 100 million times worse because it's the kind of itch where you want to take like a sharp knife and scrape your skin off. Like there's nothing you can think about other than just filleting your body. Mm. Like can't sleep, can't eat, can't do anything. It reminded me, so I've never had a migraine, but it reminded me of like friends I have that have said that like, all like their migraine is just so piercingly awful that they're nauseous and they can't even think about anything. That's like how it is. It's just like blinding itch. But the hives was from the vaccine that I got. It was sort of alarming because I've never had any response to a vaccine before, like ever. And I was like, what is this? And I took a Benadryl and it went away. But yeah.
In Ontario here for our Pfizer, the government's trying to stretch it for 4 months between first dose and second.
That was something
more protection and all that. So that's something I wanted to ask you about.
Yeah. And keep in mind too, in the province of Quebec, what they're doing is rather than doing the shot and the booster like they're supposed to with the Pfizer, they're just administering as many people as they can with the first shot and then they're worrying about them later, right, for the second.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. So I have read about it and thought about it a little bit. So it's definitely a deviation from the clinical trials because in the trials, they gave the shot and then after either 21 or 28 days, depending on which trial, they were administered their booster shot. They didn't test, at least to my knowledge, they didn't test a cohort of patients that received one shot and that was it. So they only have data about one shot up until they got their second shot. So they can only draw blood. But once they've gotten their second shot, they're now like, the data is like contaminated with the new shot, you know, so you can't use it on its own. But based on what I know from vaccine science and doing our own animal studies and just in vaccines in general is that you'll definitely want to wait a minimum of 21 to 28 days between shots because you'll have the highest antibody titers around day 28, really no matter what the vaccine is. But the booster shot is less time sensitive.
Okay.
So my best guess is that as long as you get it like within a year or so, it's going to function just the same.
So do you think that's a smart idea then for the government to try to get as much in the first shot as possible and then the second one? So this might actually be smart. We never heard of that before.
Yeah. Because the idea is if you can vaccinate more people with their first shot, mm-hmm. We know that immunity should be pretty good, even with just one shot. So getting more vaccines and more people sooner is theoretically better than getting two shots in less people. So it's sort of like an ethical problem, though, because they never test it. You're going outside the scope of what they know from the clinical trial. So it's sort of like experimenting on people, which hasn't always worked out the best in hindsight. And it's, you know, put certain groups and people at a disadvantage because, you know, widespread population testing for any medicine is probably generally frowned upon. I don't really see any reason why extending the timeline between booths should be that detrimental and probably getting it in more people is net positive.
We got to put context to your answer though, and that is because we haven't been able to procure enough vaccines to meet the 28 day timeline. So you need to understand that. I don't think maybe you do or you don't know that piece, but that is a key context to your answer. This is not something that the government just went, you know what, we're only going to buy 30 million of them or whatever, and we're just going to inoculate everybody and then wait 4 months or 3 months. It was because of the retooling of Pfizer's plant in Europe, because the fact that we do not have pharmaceutical companies making vaccines here in Canada, that we predominantly only have generic companies that make generic drugs here in Canada. This is something that the governments had to do in order to, your first point, get needles in as many arms as possible in the hopes that Pfizer's, you know, factory gets back up to speed and we start getting it in the background. So that's more of a context piece.
Got it. Yeah, it is added complexity with the distribution issues and even some issues in manufacturing and storage of the vaccines and transport. It's definitely going to be an imperfect system for the entirety of the rollout, I think. But if you end up getting a vaccine and can't get your second shot until maybe 2-3 months later, I would not be concerned. You'll still have pretty good protection after one shot, and the second shot will just ramp it up
we're still at 70 plus. That's, well, 50 plus to book your appointment, but.
Yeah, well, at least you're booking, you know.
But so. Only our 70s for the most part, 70 pluses are getting the jab.
So question for you, Sarah. And so on a side note, what does Bill Gates sound like whispering in your ear after you got the Pfizer vaccine? Just want to quickly know, if you don't mind.
Is he telling you about Windows?
Any coming, like, no? A little bit of whispering, no?
So my 5G on my phone is fully activated.
Good. Oh.
And I felt.
Yes. Okay, great.
I felt the microchip. It just like migrated from my shoulder up into my brain. And I can hear these like sonar waves pulsing.
Amazing.
And I hear him whispering to me. Actually, if I had a like straight line into his stream of consciousness, that would be so amazing, because he reads a ton of books and he reads every day and he's just like on top of everything and has obviously spouting with amazing ideas. So if that happened, I would be so happy.
Yeah, right.
Sign me up. Like,
give me 1% of that.
So, okay, on a serious note, the question I did have, could you just walk us through in layman's terms? We have obviously and if I get it wrong, please correct me. You have the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine, which is your typical, for lack of a better description, dead virus being injected. It's something that we've had for, you know, close to 100 years, lots of data, lots of, you know, clinical data on it. And then you've got the Pfizer, Moderna, and I believe Johnson & Johnson as well, being the mRNA. This new technology that they've been working on for quite a while. Pfizer, admittedly, they've been working on it a lot since 2011. Could you just take our listeners through the two differences?
But before you do that, is your universal vaccine not based on the mRNA? Okay.
It is not. So our universal flu vaccine is based on protein subunits, so it's hemagglutinin proteins, which decorate the surface of influenza virus. So it's actually, that tech is none of the current COVID vaccines. And you're right, so the AZ is more of a traditional vaccine. The J&J is actually not an mRNA vaccine. I believe it's a modified adenovirus. So it's a little bit more similar to AZ than mRNA, but it's still very different tech than AstraZeneca. I think it uses like a CMV promoter. So it's an adenovirus that infects some species of monkey, I believe, and they've basically adapted it to contain parts of the coronavirus. But the mRNA vaccines are new. So these are the first two of their kind to be approved for use. But mRNA vaccines have been studied for a long time. I think clinical trials have been going on, or at least animal studies, for almost two decades. Okay. So there's been a lot of research for them for various diseases. Influenza is one of the biggest ones. But it's one of those things where it was sort of like an out there technology, and there was no the government basically didn't see a need to start funding it aggressively because we had okay options already out there, like for the flu vaccine. That's, I guess, one of the issues with biotech innovation is that no one wants to spend the money to do the innovation until we're in like a crunch scenario where we absolutely need to survive. That's just kind of how it works. It's like, there's just, the government doesn't want to spend money on something that they don't know is going to happen. Like if they don't know for sure if and when a pandemic will happen, why would they spend money on making a coronavirus vaccine? But there's plenty of labs all over the country and the world that have been thinking about this problem for a long time and trying to get funding to work on coronavirus vaccines and different vaccine technology in general, like mRNA vaccines. But I think they're a great technology because manufacturing is super simple. You don't need to use live virus or grow it in chicken eggs like we do for the seasonal flu vaccine. It's basically you're just making DNA or RNA. And because it's just a series of nucleotides, you can basically just print it. Just kind of like a normal printer, but instead of printing on ink and paper, you're just printing nucleotides, which are just, you know, it's a chemical structure. So you just need the right starting materials and mix it up with the right stuff, and then you can print out the nucleotides in the right order. So manufacturing is relatively simple, and it's easy to update the vaccine. So like when we need to update it for like new variants or even new viruses, it's pretty easy just to plug and chug. Like, well, this is the old sequence, let's put in the new sequence, and all of a sudden it's making the new mRNA. So it's like logistically simple. The tricky parts are in the stability of it, because RNA is not particularly stable at 4 degrees or at room temperature. So they have to do a little bit of formulation work. And that's why those vaccines have I think it's minus 80 or maybe minus 20 now that they have to be stored and transported. But it's a great technology because it doesn't involve live virus. Basically, you get a shot of the RNA. It's actually called mRNA for messenger RNA. And it's the RNA that the virus uses to transcribe its genetic material into the physical protein. And it's only the mRNA for the spike protein, which is one of the surface coat proteins on the coronavirus, on SARS-CoV-2. So basically you get shot with the mRNA and it will go into your cells and into your bloodstream, and various immune cells that you have, I think specifically dendritic cells, will recognize that as foreign genetic material. And they will basically start shuttling it in to different cells of your body so that they can process that RNA and actually make that spike protein, as a little example, like, hey, what is this? This is foreign. This is what it makes. What is this thing? And then once your cells start displaying that, those bits of that spike protein, then your immune system will come and make antibodies against it. And the antibodies are what protects you from future infection. And that's basically what the whole concept of B cell mediated immunity is. Your B cells produce antibodies that will recognize that bit of the spike protein, and those antibodies will protect you. And there's also some T cell mediated immunity, which is like basically when that spike protein is chopped up and kind of turned inside out and displayed on certain types of cells, then your T cells will come along and recognize it too. So it's like basically a double gated system to make sure that if any actual coronavirus enters your body,
that's the one
right
I'll
away
take.
Your immune system could be like, okay, I've got B cells and T cells that know exactly what to do. We're going to get rid of this immediately. And then your body will actually clear out the virus before you ever would feel sick, or before the virus would have chance to replicate inside you, so that you can't spread it to others.
So then the AstraZeneca, that is the one where you're getting either a dead virus, or in like the MMR vaccine, you're actually getting a live virus, right? And so like and then that's by injecting that into your body attacks it, right? Am I correct?
Yeah, Yeah, exactly. I actually don't know, is the AZ live attenuated or is it dead?
I don't know that either.
I knew this.
MMR is live though, correct?
I think so.
Because it was, I thought I read somewhere something about mumps needing to be, having to be live because, or measles. I can't remember which one.
These are things I do at some point and I'm not exactly sure right now, but yeah, so the AZ, that's the one with Oxford. Mm-hmm. Let's see. It looks like they're also using the adenovirus. Yeah, the monkey, it's a chimpanzee adenovirus. So it basically, it's kind of like a Frankenstein virus where there's parts of the adenovirus and then I assume displaying the spike protein from coronavirus. But they use a chimpanzee adenovirus because it can infect human cells, but I don't think it can actually replicate inside of them.
Got it.
Yeah.
So what is your, if you can have an opinion to the people, because there's obviously, because of the EU predominantly, having this massive debate over blood clots, over AstraZeneca, and, you know, it's now then reached North America. And I know what any epidemiologist or biologist would say, which would be just take any vaccine you can get your hands on. But we were seeing some studies that are basically, you've got like a 1 in 500,000 chance of getting a blood clot from AstraZeneca versus a 1 in 1,000 chance of getting COVID-19 based on Ontario numbers in the last week. Can you just walk our listeners through that and just explain what this is? Because people are like, they're freaked out.
Yeah, it's an interesting dilemma because while they have shown that there is some risk associated with the AZ vaccine, the risk of developing and or dying from a severe blood clot is much, much lower than actually getting COVID and dying from that. So if you're purely looking at it from a risk perspective, it would be smarter to just get the AstraZeneca vaccine because chances are you're not going to get a clot and you're not going to die from it versus you don't get a vaccine and then you get COVID and then you die. But it's an ethical problem because if even one person, I could see the argument that if one person dies from a blood clot that's caused by the vaccine, that's one person too many. Therefore, the vaccine should not be given because it is unsafe. So that's where science and public health, they're intertwined, and it's always going to be this push and pull of what's better for the one person versus what's better for the general population. And there's just no way to quantify the value of a human life in that way. From a purely statistical and populational perspective, yeah, it's better to just give the vaccine to people. But what about on an individual level? What if you're that person that gets that blood clot? So it's a tough question, and I don't know what the best route is, but I think at least in Europe, they've been taking the more conservative stance of pulling it. It's, I think my understanding that something like 20 countries have stopped distributing it.
Yes, I don't know what the exact number is either, but yes, it's quite high.
Yeah. One thing that I was actually thinking about when I was reading about this is that, so in the clinical trials for all these vaccines, they were presumably monitoring the participants for COVID infection. So they'd get probably a COVID test every X number of days, or at least before they got their vaccine, and were being very carefully tracked for symptoms and fever and all that. So basically what we know about the safety from the clinical trials is based on people that were COVID negative when they got the vaccine. But now they're rolling out these vaccines to millions and millions, hundreds of millions of people. And they don't require you to get a COVID test before you get your vaccine.
Right.
So due to the high amount of asymptomatic spread and people that I guess what I'm saying is, I think a lot of people have been vaccinated globally that are infected with COVID and don't know it, or maybe they do and they're just like, don't know the difference, but they're infected with COVID and then they get the vaccine. And that was never studied for safety in the clinical trials. We don't know what will happen if your body is actively fighting a COVID infection and then you get a double whammy of a high dose of spike protein or whatever exact vaccine technology is the one that you got. All of a sudden, you're going to have this crazy immune response. And we don't know if that's safe. And I'm wondering if some of these side effects that are popping up as the vaccine rollout increases could be due to people that were sick and didn't know it when they got the vaccine. I think another part that kind of irks me is, like, I was reading about it in Europe when they were pulling it maybe 2 weeks ago, and all of the 13 people at the time that had a severe clot were people that are in like high risk jobs. So teachers, ICU nurses, people that have basically a greater chance than the average person of contracting COVID. So I'm wondering if they had COVID and then got the vaccine and then got that blood clot, because it can cause, we already know the virus causes a lot of spooky effects, especially with the vascular system. So I don't think we know enough about what happens if you get that double whammy.
That's actually wow. Yeah, you're right. I never even thought of it that way. Look at you, Sarah. Just a little wealth of knowledge. Yeah, you're right.
Did you get tested for COVID before you got your vaccine?
I did. So through my work, we actually get tested every Monday and Thursday. Because that's the only way that we're allowed to come to work. So we used to get tested once a week or once every 2 weeks in the beginning of the pandemic. But then once the testing sites were able to ramp up capacity, like starting in, I don't know, May or July or something, we got tested twice a week. So I've been tested now over 55 times, I think, for COVID.
Is your test the one with the big swab too, the back of your throat?
I had a few of those. I had a few of the deep brain ones when I was in Wisconsin, because when I was visiting family for 5 weeks, I just wanted to make sure I was negative, because that was actually the only time I've seen family in 14 months, and I was like, I'm going to the drive-through clinic at least once a week and getting a test. But the ones we have at work are self-administered, and they're like the shallow ones, so you just like, I just go extra long because I want to make sure I'm really getting it in there. So I do like 10 seconds in each nostril, but it's not too bad. So I'm tested every Monday and Thursday, and I have been for more than 6 months. So I'm pretty confident that I'm like 99.9% sure that I was COVID negative at the time I received my first dose and my second dose of the vaccine.
Yeah, our whole family got tested. My 11-year-old almost punched the nurse when they jammed it up his nose. He was shocked.
Made my eyes.
Oh,
water.
Your eyeball waters. Yeah. You're like, oh my God. Like, you can feel it moving your eyeball.
Oh.
Now,
have you got it, Brendan, or Trevor, or Josh? Any of you got it?
No, I haven't.
We got it right away, and it's uncomfortable for about seven seconds.
So what about if someone has already had it? My mom and dad both have the AstraZeneca. Dad, I don't know if you recall, but he got COVID in November. They said he could not go for a test subsequently for at least 60 to 90 days because he would continually test positive because of the antibodies in the system, which means he hasn't been able to go to work in the U.S. because he's basically a consultant, for lack of a better description. Would that have also someone who's maybe, you know, 60, 90 days removed from recovering from the virus, would that have a play into potentially getting blood clots?
That's really interesting that they said that he couldn't go to work. So most of the tests are PCR based tests, and they're testing for the presence of the genetic material for the virus. So as long as you've cleared the infection, that test will be negative. If they gave him a positive test because of an antibody test, then yes, he could test positive for 60 to 90 days or much longer. Because if you get sick, you might have antibodies for a year, which is a good thing. That's why that's you get antibodies right. after you get sick. Yeah. But you should not be shedding virus. You should not have an active infection for 90 days. That seems odd.
It must be the antibody. Yeah, because he could not get it. They said to him, they could not, he could not get a negative test for the next 60 to 90 days, which means his employer would not allow him back into the to the plant, right? Because he can't prove that he has a negative test. That's happened with a couple of employers here in Niagara.
That's very odd. He should just get a PCR test and it will be negative as long as he's recovered. That's just, yeah, that seems very odd.
Yeah, because when you think about for the sports, when an athlete gets in a professional team, they can't go back. And usually if they do get it 2 weeks later, yeah. they're back. But they have to do like a negative test 3 or 4 days in a row, and then they can go back.
Yeah, because they're PCR they're tests.
They're 90 days, though.
No, there's no there's no need to wait that long if they've recovered.
Interesting.
So that's interesting. But yeah, I think if you've had a COVID infection, it doesn't seem that there's any contraindications to getting the vaccine as long as you are fully recovered. I think if you're still testing positive for COVID on a PCR test, I would not get the vaccine. I would definitely wait until it is cleared.
Right.
I think that's actually in the CDC recommendations too. But at this point, I know a handful of people who had COVID, had recovered, and then got the vaccine. And just from that anecdotal evidence, they've been perfectly fine with the vaccine. But I think now, how many people globally have had COVID? I don't know. Hundreds of millions?
I think it's 130 million-ish.
Wow. And probably a large chunk of those people have been vaccinated by now. So that's good.
Not in Canada.
I guess we should have gone to Israel because Israel has vaccinated the majority of their population.
Well, there was the Bloomberg did an article on that. You know what Netanyahu did? Basically, Netanyahu basically said, "Hey, you're going to need a wide scale." I'm not paraphrasing. This is obviously not verbatim, but basically he called up Pfizer and said, "Hey, we approved your vaccine. I'm willing to pay $34 a shot if I get first dibs on everything." And that's exactly what happened. And they're open. They're on the beaches now. They're loving life.
Yeah. They also agreed to give them results and information and stuff like that, though, I believe. Okay. So they kind of, from what I understand, a test population, if you will.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was actually reading an article today that says they have this thing called like a green pass or some sort of like electronic certificate on their phone that shows that they got the vaccine, and they can use that to either scan in or check in when they go to places. So now you don't have to wear a mask and you can have like an indoor wedding, and they have obviously indoor dining and parties and beaches and kind of like that pre-pandemic lifestyle as long as you have your green pass.
Wow.
Which is just such like, it's so
what
like,
a bed.
Yeah, it's like post-apocalyptic to think of that as like the new norm, but they're trying it out. So if they never get another wave of COVID, then I guess it worked.
We can't even get our hair cut.
My wife cuts mine.
Yeah,
but I mean.
Yeah, San Francisco is also like that. It's so weird, like seeing my friends on social media who live in other cities, and they can like eat in a restaurant, and they like, I see them hanging out with friends like places that are definitely not outside, and like people seeing family, and I'm like, wow, I haven't done any of that in over a year, and I can't even get my hair cut, and it needs to get re-dyed. It's just I don't know what's going on here. But
we went to a restaurant last Friday and then it shut down the next day, so
oh no.
Yeah,
we have outdoor dining now in San Francisco. We've had that since January or February. So the outdoor dining is nice.
We've got an igloo living for the next month. We can't even leave the house.
How long is the lockdown for, Trevor?
4 weeks.
30 days, I think. Hold on. Stay-at-home order, closer, non-essentials.
Kids still going to school.
Yeah,
though,
yeah,
right? Kids are still going to school.
Thank yeah, kids God. Are still allowed to go to school as long as it's okay in the region, right? So Peel's all shut down. Cases right now worldwide are at 132 million, 2.87 million deaths. Here's some awful, awful statistics. As of April 6th, only 6 million Canadians, 16% of our population, have received one dose, and total percentage of 1.9%, 730,000, almost 731,000 have been fully vaccinated as of April 6th. So yesterday's date.
We are flying through the vaccination.
We're killing it. Woo! We're killing it. Yeah.
Just
good thing we put a lot of money into our healthcare.
How is the rollout? Because even in the U.S., we're doing a little bit better. I think we're at 100 million doses administered in the U.S. for at least one dose.
You are at 130. Yeah, you are at 130 million. As of,
I'll tell you,
you're at 35% of the population.
Right now, so as of yesterday's date, the U.S., 33% of the population, you've had 108,300,000 with at least one dose, and you are 19.2% of the population fully vaccinated, which is just over 63 million.
So double our country.
Okay.
Double.
Yeah. We got 700,000.
Double our country.
They should be jabbing 24/7, 365 right now.
We don't have the doses.
I know.
So,
Sarah can get them for us.
Right? I wish.
send them to Canada. You'll be the new.
I have no hookups. I wish I did.
Well, we did our team conference that we do annually. We did it on Zoom two Wednesdays ago now. And Dr. Sherry Cooper, our chief economist at Dominion Lending Centers, she's American, flew down with her husband down to Florida. They're staying at their condo, and the day after they arrived, they had their first shot. So
wow.
If you got money, we can hop on a plane. We can go to the States, get it taken care of. And all we have to do is show a negative COVID test within 24 hours of hopping on a plane. Right.
Yep.
Wow. I haven't been on a plane since February of 2020.
Yeah, me too. It's been a while.
I don't know when I'll go on one either.
Yeah, but so would you, like, are you ever coming up? Do you ever come up to Canada at all? Like, do you ever do that for business?
No, I never have. I've been to Vancouver once when I was in college for, like, a trip.
Whistler?
No, it was actually in January, so it was nice and cold. but I was coming from Wisconsin, so I actually brought, like, didn't bring warm things because it was so much colder in Wisconsin than Vancouver, because Vancouver is nice and temperate
and rainy
speaking. Yeah, yeah, but yeah, I was there for like a week, so I did all the main tourist stuff in Vancouver, but otherwise I haven't spent any time in Canada, although I would like to maybe in the summer.
Yeah, it's warm here and it's wine country here where we are. Do you like wine? You're in San Francisco. You're right outside of the Russian Valley there. Like, you're, oh.
Do I like wine? That's the funniest question I've ever heard. Yeah, I love wine. My boyfriend and I are both really into wine. And one of his pandemic hobbies actually was becoming certified as a wine taster through the WSET.
Yes. So he's framework. WSET. So he has his WSET? Yeah, so he's a sommelier.
Well, he has his level 3 yep. certification. Yeah. So yeah, level 4 is the highest it goes. And I guess level 4 is like a master's degree. Basically, it's like 2 years. It's like a 2-year course. And like,
so, crazy study. So here's a little thing. You have to log on to your favorite streaming site, Netflix. Hi Netflix. If you want to carry our podcast, please do. We'd love to have it. And look for the documentary called Somm, and that is following someone doing their master's sommelier, and it's like you, it's not even, it's another level. There's like literally a finite amount of people in the world. Like, it's insane.
Yeah, I've seen Psalm and Psalm 2. I've tried watching Psalm 2 twice and fell asleep both times, but I like the idea of it. I like that they made the documentary. But I love wine, and I just feel like actually learning the structure of wine, like how it's grown, what are the different techniques, what are all the different climates, like how it does soil, basically like what are all the factors and variables that go into wine, and like what are all the different wines of the world and how do they taste, and you know, all these factors. It just makes me appreciate it so much more, and all the hard work and the farming and the like earth that goes into it. So I just feel like in order to fully like be grateful for the place that I live in, I need to learn about what makes wine. And it's been a super fun pandemic hobby. Who doesn't love drinking? But I've gotten really into it, and I love like the blind taste testing. I think like my boyfriend is more into learning like different, like kind of the textbook stuff. Like he's really good at all the different regions of France and the terroir. But I'm just kind of like, pour me a glass, don't tell me what it is, and let me guess. And I think I'm like a little smidge better at that than he is, but he's definitely way better at like rifling off names of grapes and all these different things. So we like to have a little competition going on every once in a while. And as soon as we can have friends over, we're gonna have a big dinner party and a big brown paper bag wine tasting blind test. It's going to be so much fun, and I can't wait to see people.
It's great.
Well, given that cannabis is legal recreationally in California, you could do that as well. Study up all the different strains.
Yeah, I've heard people do that.
Oh, yeah.
I just feel like once I smoked out of one thing, I'd be like, okay, well, now I don't know anything. So I give up. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't really use cannabis at all. Like maybe, I don't know, I'll try an edible like once every 4 to 6 months and then regret it. And then I'll forget that I regretted it. And like 4 months later, I'll try it again. You're, like maybe I'll like it this time.
You're talking to four sommeliers of the equivalency of pot up here on this podcast.
Not me. I don't touch it. I don't touch it at all.
Yeah, because he ate a whole cookie one time.
Yeah.
It's too much for him.
Yeah, a whole cookie, like 7 cookies one time, green right out.
I use it. I use it.
I'm not a burnout, Sarah. I'm with you. I'll have some wine or beers, shots it's and great. Tequila.
0 calories and sleep like a baby. It's
oh,
amazing.
Yeah.
Oh.
I think it just like it complements some people's brain chemistry, and it just doesn't work for other people.
Oh, sure.
And for me, it just doesn't work. It just creates like a thunderstorm in my brain, and I don't like it, and I don't sleep well, and I feel weird and anxious, and I don't know, just don't like
you know,
it.
You know, have you ever been greened out or have a panic attack on it? You're done. You're done with it.
See
forever.
What the
I've had that a couple
since
times.
Becoming legal in Canada. Obviously, it's made it a lot easier to experiment. And you know, the difference in some strains, like indica strains versus sativa strains, you know, high THC, low THC, high CBD, low CBD, right? All that, Delta 8 now, all that stuff that goes into it, figuring out and kind of learning and knowing what works for you is, I don't know, Bondo's probably on the same page as me as a more active.
Don't be a playground pusher. If she doesn't want to do it,
no,
she doesn't have to do it.
Not a playground pusher at all. Just saying, hey.
Oh, yeah.
More trying to push you.
Experimenting.
On the weed.
I like
your
the
wine. Fine.
I like the idea of like the CBD heavy ones, yeah. Like where it's more CBD than THC or just CBD. Yeah. But like I'm also kind of just turned off by all those like CBD products because I feel like most of them are like not fake, but like they're not regulated in any way.
Yeah.
And like, who knows if the CBD is like degraded or of what quality or if it's soluble or like, I just don't know how to trust any of those things. So then I'm just like, well, I'm not going to waste my money on it because I could just save money.
I think it is regulated here.
Yeah. The process, it's just, so in, we've got AGCO, right. For alcohol and gaming here. And they also regulate the cannabis industry. So things are very, very well monitored, and how like testing that goes into it, extraction processes, you name it. It's very, very extensive.
We know how to get Trevor talking now, eh? Just start talking about weed. Boom.
Doesn't say anything for 40 minutes. The or get him on weed and he's,
yeah, just Daddy let him smoke him real quick here. And then boom.
No.
The Trevor Lindy Show.
Well, my grandma is 102 and she takes CBD drops under her tongue.
I believe it. That's right. Yeah. CBD's, from my perspective, I'm an anxious person. So it just kind of, you know, it helps with the anxiousness, right? So.
Yeah, I take it to sleep, but the THC, I get anxious just thinking I'm taking it.
Yeah.
I greened out after like eating 7 cookies one time and had like a meltdown. And I used to smoke pot when I was younger all the time, but I had a green out one night and like, ooh, like mushrooms, those are fun. I like that better. But
there was a few states in the last election that actually just legalized medically and recreationally psilocybin, right? Magic mushrooms.
Yep.
Really?
Yeah.
Good for migraines. My buddy takes them for migraines. Like small micro dosing, but
yeah,
loves
what,
it.
Colorado, I'm thinking.
Colorado's pretty liberal.
Yeah, so. Magic mushroom.
He's the podcast druggie. He loves it. He's just talking.
Oregon. First state,
recreational or medical?
Decriminalized and also legalize it for therapeutic use. First state.
Therapeutic.
Sarah, as much as you're teaching us, we're teaching you too. Wow. Right? You want to learn about drugs?
I had no idea. I did know that the UCSF campus in San Francisco, they just started a lab for psychedelic research, which is cool because it's now, you know, fully above board and they have some of the like best neuroscientists working on it. So it's cool progress, I guess.
I
like the idea of using psilocybin therapeutically because, you know, I read those like the Michael Pollan book and various things and some documentaries, and I definitely could see the therapeutic value in it from not like a trip out with your friends at a concert perspective.
That's fun, and it's
for a different reason, but more for like, you know, guided psychotherapy to move past problems that you were stuck otherwise or don't want to use other more mainstream medicines, you can maybe use a single dose of that instead. I think that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
And for disorders like PTSD and severe anxiety and things where there just aren't good options, like why not use that if it works?
Sure, give it a shot. Mushrooms were really fun, I can tell you that. those were probably my favorite. I didn't like being in a crowd with them outside and you're in heaven.
Yeah, I've never tried them, but I think you can actually, they're legal to grow, I think, in California. But it's not legal to buy spores, but they are legal to grow. So if you magically obtain spores, I think you're allowed to culture them.
I'm pretty sure there's lots of ways you can magically obtain spores now online.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Well,
no, try.
We'll definitely don't want to take up much more of your time. Thank you so much. But can we have you on again? Do you think you'll be able to come on again?
We'll do mushrooms together and do a podcast.
That's going to be 4 hours of giggling,
just us talking.
Oh yeah,
drooling there.
Yeah,
I'll have to. Instead of being in my bedroom, I'm in my bedroom because it's the only place in my apartment that has a door.
Right.
Otherwise, you'll hear my boyfriend on his Zoom calls. But if we do that, I'm definitely going to go to Golden Gate Park and sit under a eucalyptus tree.
And eat the eucalyptus leaves.
Also that.
That would be
just be drooling there.
Be hilarious. Yeah,
Bondo
that'll be
disappeared
front page.
Again.
I don't know where Bondo went.
That's 40. That's what happens. You turn 40, you got to pee a lot.
Oh, that's
he's 44. He's in the back.
That's me my whole life. It's like I'm the worst road trip partner because it's like every 90 minutes, it's like, okay, let's go to a gas station.
No, that's my wife because every time we go on a road trip, she starts at Tim Hortons and has to pee like every 15 minutes after
that. Started at Tim Hortons.
Oh my God, we're going to get you like a diaper. She wants to get a diaper just so she doesn't have to like stop anymore. I'm like, are you serious? I get it. Just don't drink the damn Tim Hortons. You pee in a diaper. That's gross. That's for when we're 80, not for when we're in our 40s.
What's Tim Hortons?
Tim Hortons is a...
Oh, that's like a Dunkin' Donut here.
When before you come to Canada, you got to Google that.
Canada, you love it.
I was
named after a hockey player.
So when the pandemic is over, can I come to Canada? We can do this live.
Yes, sure.
100%. Yeah.
Add a Tim Hortons.
Yeah, add a Tim Hortons.
And you know what? We'll even get you a sweet view of the Niagara Falls. There you go. We might know a guy who knows a guy.
Ooh, I would love that. Well, actually, according to the CDC, I can now travel domestically and internationally without getting a COVID test before or after travel, and I don't need to quarantine.
There you go.
Yeah.
They just released that. I wonder what they do at our border, though, if you're coming here, because they aren't open yet.
Good question.
With vaccination, because we're strict.
No, well, you know, I'm safe.
Yeah, you know, there's fine. Like next to zero restrictions when it comes to flying.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Unfortunately, that's been a big shortcoming of our process and procedures.
Well, hopefully next time we talk with you, we'll all be jabbed too, and then we can arrange something like that where we can do a wine tasting in Niagara-on-the-Lake and then go to Niagara Falls. Oh, that'd be cool.
Distillery tour.
That'd be awesome.
Brewery tour.
You could watch these people get stoned and pass out in the middle of the park in Niagara Falls.
Yeah, I would love to try some Canada wine. I've been reading all about it because – well, with climate change and everything, I guess Canada is becoming much more favorable to grow grapes.
Right.
Same with like Pacific Northwest. And I don't know, maybe Canada is the next Napa.
Well, it's killing our ice wine because we're not getting some serious winters anymore.
Yeah.
I think in here, so that's tough now. But yeah, we'll have to do that. I think that'd be cool.
Our region is pretty high in grape growing as well for terms of Canada, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
We're the new Napa Valley.
I don't think I've ever had Canadian wine, now that I think of it.
Try Ontario wine.
I'm going to look for that at the little wine shop near my house because I always like to try like new little, like I've been really into South African wine lately.
Oh, yeah.
That's really good. And just kind of diversifying my portfolio outside of California.
What do we got for wineries in Southern Ontario here? We got 70 different wineries at least.
Close to 100 now. Yeah,
there's some good wines here. The ladies love it.
Wow. Oh, that reminds me, it's Wine Wednesday.
There you go.
Me and my boyfriend get really excited about Wednesday nights because that's when we can start drinking wine.
Are you a red wine drinker or a white wine?
I like all wine.
Just not mixed together, right?
Well, even, you know, homemade rosé is not the worst thing.
No, blush.
But I would say I'm more red, but we usually don't drink anything Sunday through Tuesday, to, you know, have a solid chunk of a cleanse every week. But then Wednesday's Wine Wednesday, and we get super excited.
It's a good hump day.
Yeah. Yeah.
I got to get blasted Saturdays, so.
Says the guy who earlier in this conversation told us, well, I really only drink once or twice a month.
Once or twice.
Well, I do, though, but on Saturdays when I do it, because I think Sunday's
stay away
off
from
now,
a hit of THC because I greened out one time, but I get blasted on Saturday nights. Don't even remember my name. Yeah, because that's going to be good.
I don't remember my name. I don't get that blasted. Not when I was in my 20s anymore, but I'll have a good hangover on Sunday. Usually.
Yeah,
not the last time.
In the pandemic, I have to say, like, I still drank a lot more than I expected for having no social life.
Yeah. I'll give Brandon credit, though. He talked me into Guinness, and now I like the Guinness beer.
Oh, I like
that's
Guinness.
A good, nice. Yeah, you can eat it with a fork. Everybody jokes about it, but I find it super smooth. I find it super smooth. That was some shots of DiSorono. Woo! Hey, Brando, I just gave you credit on your Guinness.
Oh, Guinness is great.
It was your sales pitch that got me on it. You have two pints and then you're
two
good to
pints
go.
And then the third pint, you're hooked. And it's the healthier beer.
No, that's all I drink is Guinness. Guinness and some Patrons.
When you're sitting down and drinking Guinness, how do you get to the third pint? I'm full after one.
Really?
I disagree. I find going to like an MGD now or something like that is like drinking
100%.
Water.
And it's more gassy.
But I find it like the smoothest beer going, the Guinness one now. Like it's so milky smooth when you pour it. That's the good stuff. The Irish know what they're doing.
They certainly do.
Yeah. Some Irish convinced me to take a shot of whiskey yesterday because I've been swimming in the bay and in the Pacific Ocean like a whole bunch because that's my recent pandemic hobby. And sometimes I swim with this group called the Irish Pod. A lot of them are Irish, but some of them aren't. But they go on these like really hardcore swims. Nobody wears a wetsuit. They're in the water for like an hour plus. They're all fast and like just hardcore. Just like tough as nails, cold water swimmers. And then they take shots of Jameson afterwards.
You got to warm up somehow. Warm you up,
right? Yep. Yeah.
So you got whiskey Tuesdays and then wine Wednesdays. And then what's Thursdays?
Well, beer Thursdays. So whiskey Tuesday is kind of a problem because I'm not supposed to drink alcohol Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. So yesterday I was like, I'm having a dilemma because I'm with the Irish
pandemic
pod.
Lifestyle.
You like have to warm up. Warm up.
So Thursdays, I guess just thirsty Thursday. Thursday's like finish whatever we didn't finish on Wednesday. And then Friday. So Friday after.
Well, Friday's the weekend, so you gotta,
yeah. Yeah, recharge. Fridays I tend to drink a little too much because after work on Fridays, I swim with my like my main swim pod at China Beach with this like little secluded, like, kind of hidden beach in San Francisco that not many people know about. And it's dangerous for swimming, but also super awesome if you know the conditions and are a strong swimmer. But I do that every Friday after work, and it's just so fun and it's just so awesome to be in the cold water and the waves and just go for an hour swim. And then we'll bring like really nice wine and cheese, like, you know, bottles of wine from like 1990s, early 2000s. There's some people who are, you know, we're cracking 20-year-old bottles of wine pretty frequently, like really high-end stuff on this grimy little beach cement platform. And then people will make like homemade bread and bring like,
but really that's living
cheeses.
That's, yeah, living, it's right, like, there. I'll take that any day of the week.
Yeah, it's like super grimy and gnarly and windy and cold, but also like extra deluxe in terms of like the gourmet factor.
Well, 20-year-old
Brando and I drank a nice bottle of wine out of Dixie cups, remember, Brent?
Oh, what, when Dr. Mac opened up the back vintage of Massey Amarone? That, tell that to your W set 3 boyfriend now, Sarah. So we were up at the cottage. It's just boys trip, just a little golf trip that we do. And so we got a buddy, he's from Newfoundland, he's a Cairo. You know, he's just a goofy newfie. We love him to death. And so he brings Beauty. So I got him for opening up his practice, him and his wife, I bought a like 05 5-star vintage of Massey Amarone. So it'd be about $100 bottle now, like when you sell it. We're blitzed, right?
I'm writing it down.
Yeah, Matt Massey, M-A-S-I, and then Amarone is the type of wine. And
okay,
it was an 05 back vintage, and Dr. Mac whips out some Dixie cups and freaking cracks the bottle, and then he just, like, we all start drinking this high-end bottle of Amarone through Dixie cups. We're like, all right, well, I guess that's what we're going to do.
And then he passed out.
We put popcorn all over him. And then, because he started like chirping us that we weren't drinking and keeping up with the newfie, which they can drink, to be fair. Like, they can. They're good. They're known for that. And yeah.
The wow. Newfie.
Yeah. Love Newfoundlanders. Love them.
Beauties.
Yeah, if you want to go to a nice place in Canada, go to Newfoundland or PEI. That's gorgeous out there. Yeah, that's prime time.
Yeah, I'd love to. I can't say I've ever had nice wine out of a Dixie cup before, but I have had like plenty of shots of whiskey and stuff just from, you know, college and also just like work happy hours and stuff. Like, didn't have anything available, so we would drink it out of little Dixie cups, and like the high alcohol content like melts the waxy stuff so the bottom turns like clear and starts leaking. I'm like, oh, this is not good.
Well, at least you're putting that in your body, right?
Yeah. Sure.
Hilarious. Oh.
All right. Well, let's set it up for next time then. When she can come to Canada, we'll do a live one. I think that'd be cool if we can ever get out of the freaking pandemic.
That'd be awesome. And if it's not going to happen in the near future, certainly happy to do another one of these.
Yes.
From my bedroom.
And then we can have your swimming because you're a big swimmer, and we can touch on that the next episode.
Let's do it. Yeah, I don't think I was even a swimmer last time I talked to you guys, but I was just sort of overwhelmed with life and stress starting in like October from work and
that's just recent. In the ocean we'll save that to the next one. We'll save because I follow you on the gram.
We'll have our pools open.
The kids say the gram.
What'd you say?
Let's do it,
Collins.
We'll all have our pools open too. So,
ooh, yeah. I'm not a pool swimmer, so I'm curious to try one out. But
we'll see. Best. Curry's just got dropped in his backyard last week. Landscaping's happening. Mine goes in end of May, beginning of June.
Ooh,
and the other two already have one.
Yep.
I'm getting another one. I'm ordering another one though.
You're Ellen Pools, buddy.
Well, you guys.
I think I'm gonna.
So, but thanks very much for popping by.
Yeah.
We love having you. It's great. It's awesome.
And thanks for telling us your alcohol, your habits now. Now we know. don't do it on a Wednesday.
Wine thanks, Wednesday. Sarah. All right. Thanks, guys. This was super fun. Talk to you next time.
Thanks, Sarah. Bye.
Take care.
Okay. Bye. Right.
And Vonda, you want to close us out?
Help us help you stay informed.
I'm Jeff Woods, and I'm shining a light on music and the rock stars who make it.
He just was one of those people. He stood out.
He was a magic guy. He really was a magic guy. We all have force. He had the same amount of force as we all have.
This was before Led Zeppelin. Robert was full on. I mean, he was Led Zeppelin without the band behind him. He had the hair, the jeans, the whole thing, you know. And he was amazing.
The Records and Rockstars podcast, heard around the world and yours to hear wherever you get podcasts. All the episodes from JeffWoodsRadio.com.
Do, Did, Will, the Story of People podcast is now available on the Crier Media Network. The first 5 episodes are here and feature some incredible guests that fit into one or all 3 of those categories. Ready? Tara Sloan from the San Jose Sharks, Undercurrent podcast at NBC Sports. Marianne Iveson from Iveson Voice and the Let's Take This Outside podcast to talk about the world of outdoors as well as voiceover land. Ariana Hunsicker, future Canadian Paralympic swimmer, already winning tons of awards for this country. Scott McGregor from the Hot Wallet podcast to dumb down the world of crypto, Bitcoin, and NFTs so you don't have to. And Jackie Holowaty from Climate Pledge Arena in Seattle, Washington, the first net zero carbon certified arena on the planet. Wherever you get your pods, wherever you watch your pods, and on the Crier Media Network.
Produced by Crier Media and distributed by the Sound Off Media Company.